The topic, I think we exchanged email, and I don't know that he told you what title I suggested we use for this, but it was something about, oh yeah, here it is, here's the topic, constitutional apostasy, how our original inspired constitution has become compromised by the neglect, ambition, and ignorance of those who inherited a divinely inspired original pattern. Which is pretty much what I want to talk about, or what I intend to talk about. Sometimes the way that you accomplish an objective is indirectly. You accomplish it as a byproduct. You don't stare into the sun. You take advantage of what the sun has to offer indirectly, because it'll damage you if you go staring at it. The clearest way to make it apparent is in our legal system. We have what's called an adversarial system. The adversarial system has as its objective the byproduct of finding the truth. That's not what you aim at. The adversarial system has an attorney who represents one side, and his objective is to tell you everything that is in favor of his side, and then to point out all of the weaknesses, all of the mistakes of the other side. And then the other side's attorney has the exact same goal. Neither one of them is trying to tell you the whole story. They are employed, they are trained, and they are prepared to give you everything that can be mustered in the evidence, in the proof, in the testimony to support one side. Then a third party is the decision maker. Whether that third party is a judge or a jury, the third party decision maker listens to what both sides have to say, and they determine what is the truth. The truth is the byproduct of this adversarial system. The alternative to that is an inquisitorial system. And we do not have an inquisitorial system. Because if you're going to take directly the objective of accomplishing the truth, then under an inquisitorial system, as Torquemada demonstrated in the Iberian Peninsula during the Inquisition, get out the branding irons. Get out the rack. I mean, if we can get to the truth by an inquisitorial system, then why not use torture in furtherance of the objective of trying to accomplish the truth? And so truth is not the objective of the adversarial system that we use in the United States. Truth is the byproduct of the system we use, because you get far more truth through an adversarial system than you ever obtain through an inquisitorial system, because people will lie to avoid the problems imposed upon them as a part of the Inquisition. Well, the objective of the Constitution is really simple. There are a whole lot of things that are a byproduct of this one objective. But the one objective of the Constitution is to end tyranny. And so everything within the system is designed in order to accomplish as its byproduct ending tyranny. Because if anyone knew what tyranny was, it was the colonialists who found it unbearable to live under the system of a foreign king ruling them and imposing taxes upon them disproportionately, so that they, the colonialists, were required to pay more taxes so that those back in the home country didn't have to pay taxes on some things, or paid far less tax, because though they were all subjects of the same monarchy, the monarch elected not to treat them equally and to tax them evenly, but to choose some to be benefited through the tax system and to choose others to punish under the tax system. And so they found that the system was intolerable. The reason why we wind up with those kinds of excesses is because of human frailty. This interesting, incident that happens that we have preserved in the Doctrine and Covenants, in which Joseph Smith is in the Liberty Jail, and he's been there for about 5 months at the time of the writing of this letter, an excerpt of which is in DNC 121. And he is groaning under the oppression of the state government that has arrested him using the state militia, accused him of treason against the state, and held him without trial in a Missouri dungeon for 5 months in conditions that were brutal. And in those circumstances, he writes, and the writing is inspired, "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." What's interesting about what we have in Doctrine and Covenants section 121 is that Joseph Smith is confined and oppressed by a government authority. And in the extremity of being subjected to imprisonment without due process by the government of Missouri, and Joseph complaining, because if you have the rest of the letter, which is in the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, if you read the rest of the letter, what he's complaining about, what he's asking God for, is to avenge the governmental oppression of him. And as the Lord often does, the purpose of putting Joseph through the oppression in a dungeon is to tell him something about priesthood. The Lord ignores, you know, lay waste to the government. Instead, he takes the occasion to say, okay, Joseph, now maybe you can understand something. Here's what I was hoping you would understand. "Behold, there are many called, but few are chosen. And why are they not chosen? Because their hearts are so set upon the things of this world and aspire to the honors of men that they do not learn this one lesson, that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, and that the powers of heaven cannot be controlled nor handled only upon the principles of righteousness, that they may be conferred upon us, it's true, but when we undertake to cover our sins or gratify our pride, our vain ambition, or to exercise control or dominion or compulsion upon the souls of the children of men in any degree of unrighteousness, behold, the heavens withdraw themselves. The Spirit of the Lord is grieved, and when it is withdrawn, amen to the priesthood or the authority of that man." See, no power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood. Only, you don't have any authority by virtue of that. You have authority by virtue of only persuasion. That's your tool, persuasion. And since that's not going to work, the second tool is long-suffering. Because all you're armed with is persuasion. You can't say, "I'm the authority, you need to do this. I'm the authority, the thinking has been done." If all I've got is persuasion, then I better be willing to be long-suffering, because I'm not going to bring you on board to the truth anytime soon. And then gentleness. I don't care how frustrated you get. And meekness and love unfeigned. by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul. These are the tools. So Joseph is suffering from governmental oppression, complaining about the government, and the Lord says, good, now maybe you can understand the way the priesthood works, because this crap you're going through, if you think it's bad when someone has a militia, oh, you just wait, Joseph. As it rolls forward and people have possession of priestly office, you see what happens. We've been through that. It's called Catholicism. The Lord's focus, as is often the case, is not on the thing that Joseph was asking about, but it was about what the Lord wanted us to understand. And there are other reasons why the Constitution matters to Latter-day Saints. Doctrine and Covenants, section 101, tells us, and this is really interesting, section 101, verse 76, and again I say unto you, those who have been scattered by their enemies, it is my will that they should continue to importune for redress and redemption by the hands of those who are placed as rulers and are in authority over you. See, the Lord didn't say, based upon the Missouri persecutions and the loutishness of Governor Boggs, dispatch Orrin Porter Rockwell and take the guy out. He says, those who are placed as rulers and are in authority over you. You know, the solution doesn't lie in the end of a barrel. Petition them. And do it, 77, according to the laws and constitution of the people, which I have suffered to be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles. That's what the Constitution was designed to accomplish. And when the Lord says that it was established for just and holy purposes, we ought to be approaching constitutional issues with the same sense of the sacred as DNC 121 talks about respecting the rights of conscience and belief. So it's just and it is holy, the Constitution. That every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the days of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the constitution of this land by the hands of wise men whom I raised up unto this very purpose and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. So I want you to note that what we are told in Doctrine and Covenants section 101 in the revelation given to Joseph is that the constitution was established by the Lord's hand through men he raised up for that purpose, to establish just and holy principles that will protect the rights of all men. What it does not say is that having raised those just and holy men up, that you have a guarantee that forever thereafter you will have in a position of authority over you running the government of the United States in perpetuity just and holy men whom the Lord has raised up. He put it in place. He put it in operation. He turns it over to us. Then the question is, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with what you've been entrusted with? That's the question. The Lord did his part. Now it's up to us. The Constitution gets mentioned again, not in a revelation. 101 is a revelation. It gets mentioned in the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple in section 109. And Joseph says in the prayer, have mercy, O Lord, upon all the nations of the earth. Have mercy upon the rulers of our land. May those principles which were so honorably and nobly defended, namely the Constitution of our land by our fathers, be established forever. Well, we have a declaration of belief on how governments ought to behave. That's section 134. We believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man, that he holds men accountable, and so on. We believe, I like verse 2. We believe that no government can exist in peace except such laws are framed and held inviolate as will secure to each individual the free exercise of conscience, the right and control of property, and the protection of life. It's interesting that we have in 134 the reference to property. John Locke talked in terms of life, liberty, and property. In the Declaration, it was reworded to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You have to understand the Scottish Enlightenment and what happiness meant, because that was a very specific phrase. The word happiness doesn't mean I got an Xbox and I got a noggin full of cocaine and I'm happy now. That's not it. Happiness had a highly specific meaning. It meant that you were living your life in conformity with the will of God. They believed in natural law. Natural law meant that it was ordained by God. It was given to all men. And when you brought your life into harmony with natural law, with the will of God, then you became happy. So life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness means life, liberty, and that you were living your life in conformity with the will of God, which would bring about happiness. John Locke cut to the quick, which was property. Query where we would be even with the 16th Amendment if property were in there. Well, 1 Nephi 13, there's a series of verses in there that is just giving the prophetic foreshadowing, the foretelling of what was going to happen when the Gentiles became the inheritors of this land. And beginning at verse 12. And I looked and I beheld a man among the Gentiles who was separated from the seed of my brethren by many waters. I beheld the Spirit of God, that it came down and wrought upon the man. And he went forth upon the many waters, even into the seed of my brethren who were in the promised land. There's your answer to the question of whether people got the Holy Ghost without laying on of hands at some point. I mean, Columbus was inspired by the... Anyway. Came to pass, I beheld the Spirit of God that it wrought upon other Gentiles, and they went forth out of captivity upon the many waters. So it wasn't just Columbus. It was your own ancestors who were wrought upon by the Holy Ghost to come and occupy this land. Even though two of my ancestors were children in the Liverpool area who accepted a free afternoon boat ride from a captain who was loading the boat up with children and then proceeded to sail from Liverpool to the United States, well, to the colonies, where he sold the children off as indentured servants. And one of those was a boy and another one was a girl who were sold to the same family as indentured servants, and they, when they worked their way through the indentured servitude and they were free, they married one another. And so I guess the Spirit works directly on some and through captains on others. In any event, came to pass, I beheld many multitudes of the Gentiles upon the land of promise. I beheld the wrath of God. It was upon the seed of my brethren. They were scattered before the Gentiles and were smitten. Beheld the Spirit of the Lord. It was upon the Gentiles. They did prosper and obtain the land for their inheritance. And I beheld that they were white and exceedingly fair and beautiful, like unto my people before they were slain. Which tells you that what he's talking about is the ones who were the designated inheritors match a specific description and fit within a certain ethnicity called Gentile. And it came to pass that I, Nephi, beheld that the Gentiles who had gone forth out of captivity did humble themselves before the Lord, and the power of the Lord was with them. I beheld that their mother Gentiles were gathered together upon the waters and upon the land also to battle against them. I beheld that the power of God was with them, and also the wrath of God was upon all those that were gathered together against them to battle. And I beheld that the Gentiles that had gone out of captivity were delivered by the power of God out of the hands of all other nations. Well, you'd have to know a lot about our early history to know just how very true that is. Sometimes you ought to look into the Battle of New York and how Washington managed to escape. And he was the last one to leave that morning. He wanted all of the troops withdrawn before he would leave and enter the boat himself. And but for the intervening fog bank, the American Revolution would have ended that day. The hand of God was throughout it. In fact, Washington talked about the hand of providence ruling throughout. Then we have Jacob's teaching in 2 Nephi chapter 10. And Jacob, the one that Nephi thought so much of as a teacher that he gave chapters of his own writing over to his brother, younger brother, Jacob. Jacob teaching in chapter 10, beginning at verse 10, says, "But behold, this land, said God, shall be a land of thine inheritance, and the Gentiles shall be blessed upon the land. And this land shall be a land of liberty unto the Gentiles. And there shall be no kings upon the land who shall raise up unto the Gentiles. And I will fortify this land against all other nations. And he that fighteth against Zion shall perish, saith God. For he that raiseth up a king against me shall perish. For I, the Lord, the King of heaven, will be their king. And I will be a light unto them forever that hear my words." Well, we all know the story of the Book of Mormon, how there were kings and how there were kingmen and how there were those. I mean, it doesn't mean that there will not be, at least temporarily, those that manage in this land to establish temporary monarchies and oppress. It just means that the ultimate destiny of kingship on this land is failure. And therefore, there we are. So we now know what the background is, and we know that there is this effort to create systems to guard against tyranny that have as their byproduct the freedom of the people. And so we look at the Constitution and say, how exactly is it then that the Constitution managed to establish a framework inside of which it's possible to preserve freedom? Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says that all legislative powers granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Then Article 1, Section 3 tells us how the Senate operates. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years. And each senator shall have one vote. Okay? So the Senate of the United States consists of this group, two senators, and they are chosen by the legislature of the state. Now, you might say, well, we fixed that. Yeah, we kind of did. We don't have any problem with the idea that there are positions that are held within the United States which have extraordinary authority granted to them, but who are not elected by the people. Every United States federal judge is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Every sitting member of the United States Supreme Court is appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. We don't elect federal judges. We elect men or women who choose. We elect men who choose. We've yet to get a woman. The inevitability of that, however, is certain. We elect men, they choose, Senate confirms, and none of us sit back and say, wait a minute, we didn't get to vote. None of us question the authority or the dignity or the legitimacy of their power. And the Supreme Court becomes, of course, the court of last resort in the country. Somehow, however, when it comes to the legislature of the United States, when the United States Senate became a creature of the legislatures, rather than being elected directly by the people, we found it so intolerable that we amended the Constitution in order to provide for the direct election of United States senators. Well, when they were putting together the United States Constitution and they had a skeptical public, they published a series of articles, Madison and a few of his cohorts, anonymously, in the Federalist Papers, and the Federalist Papers 62 and 63 explain the purpose behind the way in which the Senate was organized. This is just talking about the United States Senate in the mechanism that gets used to choose the United States Senate. It is recommended by the double advantage of favoring a select appointment and of giving to the state governments such an agency in the formation of the federal government as must secure the authority of the former. Secure the authority of the former, the state government, and may form a convenient link between the two systems. The United States Senate was designed to be a link between, on the one hand, the state and the state authority, that is the state legislatures, and the federal government. Because the Senate was the creature that was selected by, appointed by, chosen by the state legislatures and therefore answerable to them. The equality of representation in the Senate is another point, which being evidently the result of compromise between the opposite pretensions of the large and small states. Among independent and sovereign states, bound together by a simple league, the parties, however unequal in size, ought to have an equal share in the common councils. We're trying to protect the identity of the various states as independent and sovereign. The equal vote allowed to each state is at once a constitutional recognition of the proportion of sovereignty remaining in the individual states, and an instrument for preserving that residuary sovereignty, to guard by every possible expedient against an improper consolidation of the states into one simple republic. It was never the objective to have the United States of America become correlated so that they're all singing the same hymn, preaching the same lesson every week in uniformity from sea to shining sea. That was never the intent. It was always the intent that there be independence and recognition of the sovereignty of each of the individual sovereign units. who were entitled to elect their own representation and then have their representatives choose who the senator would be at the beck and call of the legislature, to go back to Washington and to guard the rights of the state. It's a simple system. Think about it. Dividing the power is a salutary check on the government. It doubles the security to the people by requiring the concurrence of two distinct bodies in schemes of usurpation, whereby the ambition or corruption of one would otherwise be sufficient. This is a precaution founded on such clear principle and now so well understood in the United States that it would be more than superfluous to enlarge on it. I will barely remark that as the improbability of sinister combinations will be in proportion to the dissimilarity in the genius of the two bodies, it must be politic to distinguish them from each other by every circumstance, which will consist with a due harmony in all proper measures and with the genuine principles of Republican government. You see, here's the way that works. The way in which you choose the Congress, the House of Representatives, is by direct election. And by direct election, you can be informed by all sorts of passion, prejudice, trends, stupidity, fads. All kinds of things can briefly inflame the passions of those people that are elected by the public directly. But the legislature, out of which the United States Senate grows, the legislature is a completely different kind of body. The legislature in the states only turns over so often. And the legislature is the ones that are holding the reins on the Senate. So when the senators go back there, the things they care about, the fashions of the day, the passions of the people are quieted, are mollified, are subdued to some extent, because the Senate doesn't have that same problem with direct election as does the House of Representatives. And this is a wise purpose because of the improbability of sinister combinations in proportion to the dissimilarity between the House and the Senate. Therefore, what you want is dissimilarity. What you want is for them to reckon from different gene pools altogether. What you want is the Senate to be something far different than the House of Representatives. You don't want them running around with, campaign slogans and yard signs and, in the early days, barrels of whiskey at the polling stations. Now, why are we trying to create such disparity between the two bodies? It's because at the time that the Constitution was being discussed, no small share of the present embarrassments of America is to be charged on the blunders of our government, and that these have been produced from the heads rather than the hearts of most of the authors of them. A good government implies two things. First, fidelity to the object of government, which is the happiness of the people. Secondly, a knowledge of the means by which the object can best be attained. The internal effects of mutable policy are still more calamitous. It poisons the blessings of liberty itself. It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood. If they be repealed or revised before they are promulgated or undergo such incessant changes that no man who knows what the law is today can guess what it will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, but how can that be the rule which is little known and less fixed? Great injury results from an unstable government. The want of confidence in the public councils dampens every useful undertaking, the success and profit of which may depend on a continuance of the existing arrangements. What prudent merchant will hazard his fortunes in any new branch of commerce when he knows not but that his plans may be rendered unlawful before they be executed? What farmer or manufacturer will lay himself out for the encouragement given to any particular cultivation or establishment when he can have no assurance that his preparatory labors and advances will not render him a victim to an inconstant government? The United States Senate was designed to be chosen by the legislature in order to prevent the incessant changing of the law and to provide a stability by which the government could become predictable, its laws known. Change would not be rapid. There could not be an agenda. I'm running on a platform. Here's my platform. I got me this here agenda. We are going to transform America. We are going to make us a new one. We're going to implement. And if we can't get implementation any other way, then we're going to executive order our way through. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I thought it said that the legislative power, all legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Okay, so that's Article 1. We don't get to the executive until we get to Article 3 or 2. Article 2 is so. Yeah, well. If you had a Senate doing its job, you wouldn't be faced with those issues. In the next circular of the Federalist paper, the Federalist 63, still talking about the United States, says the people can never willfully betray their own interests, but they may possibly be betrayed by the representatives of the people. And the danger will be evidently greater where the whole legislative trust is lodged in the hands of one body of men rather than when the concurrence of separate and dissimilar bodies is required in every public act. The purpose was not merely to make them separately elected and to divide them into two terms, one for two and one for 6 years. It was to make them dissimilar. The creature that is called the United States Senate and the creature that is called the House of Representatives was designed on purpose to be dissimilar. And so anything you do to break down the dissimilarity and anything you do to create the similarity between the two bodies is designed to undermine the very purpose that the system that was established was designed to guard against. Well, they talk about how you can transform and corrupt our country. But in accomplishing that, before such a revolution can be effected, the Senate, it is to be observed, must in the first place corrupt itself. Must next corrupt the state legislatures, must then corrupt the House of Representatives, and must finally corrupt the people at large. It is evident that the Senate must first must be first corrupted before it can attempt an establishment of tyranny. Without corrupting the state legislatures, it cannot prosecute the attempt, because the periodic change of members would otherwise regenerate the whole body. Without exerting the means of corruption with equal success in the House of Representatives, the opposition of that co-equal branch of the government would inevitably defeat the attempt. And without corrupting the people themselves, a succession of a few representatives would speedily restore all things to their pristine order. Is there any man who can seriously persuade himself that the proposed Senate can, by any possible means within the compass of human address, arrive at the object of a lawless ambition through all these obstructions? Yes, if you remove one of them, if you get rid of the legislative control over them, because then you aggregate power at the federal level, and the legislatures of the various states become servants, not sovereigns, they become servants to a homogenized single federal unity. The federal Senate will never be able to transform itself by gradual usurpations into an independent and aristocratic body. When I was growing up in Idaho, the reaction to that would be, my ass. You know, the United States Constitution was amended in the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, and it provides, the Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state elected by the people thereof for 6 years. If you wanted to do one thing to change the course of the United States, repeal the 17th Amendment. Repeal the 17th Amendment. Overnight, the issue of whether or not the states have legislative authority and independent sovereignty would be reestablished with one change. And it's never going to happen, because the moneyed interests at this point are so far entrenched in this system, and the political parties are so behind this manner of accomplishing the taxing and the gathering and the paying, that Washington simply is off the leash. And the leash came through the United States Senate. And the 17th Amendment cut the leash. And therefore, what we have is exactly the problem that we face today. Well, never question the wisdom of the folks that the Lord raised up, holy men who he raised up in order to establish a system. And just realize, anytime you tinker with the system, any system that God put in place, you're going to yield, I was going to say, unexpected consequences. But that's just, you're going to apostatize from the purpose, and you deprive yourself of the intended blessing God hoped when he entrusted the system to you to bless you with. That's the first point. There's one other point I want to talk about. When the United States of America was established, the United States had about 200 years of slavery that had been built into the core of the country when the United States was a colony. And it had no right as a colony to resist the importation of a slave class. And so when the United States of America gained independence from England, slavery was an existing economic fact that had been built into the society itself. It's interesting, some of the debates that took place during the drafting of the Constitution, because one of the theories, and it was a real theory that bright men considered. One of the theories was that it was impossible to produce the required educated and idle class. And by idle class, that means someone that doesn't have to go out and labor in the field with the strength of their body in order to provide the means to feed and clothe and house themselves. You could not produce the required idle class unless you had slavery, because there was no historical precedent for it. And they debated that. And the problem was that history suggested that that argument was an argument that could be made and could be considered. So when independence was achieved against the existing reality of slavery. Now, Washington, who was the only man considered to be president of the United States, in fact, the office of the president was written, it was designed for one occupant, and that was George Washington. He was the indispensable man in creating this country. Washington was the one who presided over the Constitutional Convention and contributed almost nothing to the debates other than his presence. And when they reached an impasse, the way they solved the impasse was Washington indicated which side he favored. When they took it out to sell it to the public, the salesmanship that was done was that George Washington presided over this. Everyone trusted that man. Therefore, they adopted an office for that man, and he filled it for two terms, and then he resigned and he walked away. Something that everyone would respect by his mere example until it was necessary after FDR to amend the Constitution again to prevent that from not being the example. Washington, when he died, freed his slaves. He didn't do it while he was alive, but he did it in death. If everyone followed the example of Washington with time, there would have been no more slavery. Here's the problem, however. Since the institution had been imposed upon the United States as a colony, and since it represented wealth, it represented capital, however offensive to you it may be today to say human beings are not capital, the economic reality was that slaves were capital and they represented an investment. So the question becomes, how do you extract yourself from the institution of slavery when you have an economic system in which people have invested capital in human slaves? How do you bring that to a conclusion? Because, quite frankly, if all you do is terminate the practice, you would bankrupt the South. It is probable that the cotton gin alone made the end of slavery inevitable, because it became a problem with the coming Industrial Revolution. One of the first edges of which was the cotton gin. The coming Industrial Revolution made it no longer necessary to have human bondage in order to accomplish it. It wasn't just the ownership of African slaves in the South. It was indentured servitude in the North. Indentured servitude was a way of selling yourself or someone else into slavery for a period of time. And servitude was an economic means for producing goods and services. Well, how do you extract yourself? Joseph Smith published when he was running for the presidency of the United States, General Smith's views of the powers and policy of the government of the United States out of Nauvoo, Illinois in 1844. And this is an excerpt from his campaign. Petition also, this is his platform, petition also, ye goodly inhabitants of the slave states, your legislators to abolish slavery by the year 1850 or now, and save the abolitionists from reproach and ruin, infamy and shame. Pray Congress to pay every man a reasonable price for his slaves out of the surplus revenue arising from the sale of public lands and from the deduction of pay from the members of Congress. Break off the shackles from the poor black man and hire them to labor like other human beings, for an hour of virtuous liberty on earth is worth a whole eternity of bondage. Joseph Smith's proposal in 1844 was, here's how we end slavery. We buy them. We pay the purchase price. We purchase their freedom. Now think about that for a moment as a matter of economic reality. If you are a slave owner and someone offers the fair price to you for your entire group of slaves and you sell them into freedom, you now have capital, the capital that you spent buying them, and with your capital, you can hire them. And the people who were formerly merely a commodity now become wage earners. But what happens if instead of doing as Joseph Smith proposed, you simply destroy the capital of the South by saying, no more slavery. No more slavery. Instantly you bankrupt the South. Instantly you doom the freed slave to no longer having anyone who has the capital with which to employ them. Instantly you leave the South in a position where, out of economic reality, what you do, since you own land, is you start a sharecropping system in which the risk of crop failure falls upon those who can least afford to bear the risk of crop failure. That is the former slaves. What Joseph Smith proposed would not have required Reconstruction. What Joseph Smith proposed would not have cost the Civil War. What Joseph Smith's proposal would have accomplished was the end of slavery. And what Joseph Smith's proposal would have accomplished with the end of slavery was the economic means by which the former slave could rise out of poverty through labor, because that's all anyone was doing at that time, through their own labor, and accomplish through their employment the dignity of holding a job and earning an income. But what we accomplished instead was another revolution that has constitutional implications. The deadliest enemy that the United States has ever faced is another American, and the Civil War proves it. There is no more effective and warlike people on earth than the Americans. And when the Americans faced the Americans and blood was shed, we punished ourselves for slavery. And in the wake of the Civil War, the Civil War amendments, if you take a look at what happened with the Civil War amendments, once again, it was a power shift. The way in which slavery was designed to end was gradually and in a way that made economic sense. The way in which it did end imposed another century of slavery upon the liberated slaves in the South as a matter of economic reality. It just was. You'd never have had share. I mean, the only thing they had was land. So what do? You let them farm the land. And then the crops that come off the land, you charge them. You take it. And you doom them to poverty. Well, if you look at what happened in connection with the Civil War, in contrast to the wisdom of what Joseph Smith suggested as an exit strategy to terminate the practice of slavery, you realize that the choice that we made between the two of them not only resulted in another century of problems following the Civil War and the freedom of the slaves and the bankruptcy of the Southern slave owners, it also resulted in oppression of the former slaves, because they succeeded into freedom in an economic environment in which it was impossible for them to make value out of what they had to offer, that is, their labor. The amendments were designed to curtail the rights of the states and to impose upon the individual states the same due process of law through the 14th Amendment that we have in the federal government. You see, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion in the First Amendment. However, that didn't apply to the state legislatures, which is why Thomas Jefferson, as President of the United States, refused to acknowledge Thanksgiving as a national holiday because it was religious. And when he became governor of the state of Virginia, he not only celebrated Thanksgiving as a state holiday, but he also had a day of fasting, religious fasting, the day before. The state could not have a state religion. I mean, the United States could not have a state religion, but the states could and did. The 14th Amendment ended that. What that literally meant at the beginning is that independent, sovereign, and equal states could experiment. You could have the state of Utah with a state religion called Mormonism or Latter-day Saintism. And you could have, like they did to the citizens of Massachusetts, a tax that was imposed by the state, collected by the state, and paid over to a church. You could do like the LDS Church used to do with employees of ZCMI. That is, they had a payroll deduction for tithing, and they deducted it from, if you're employed at ZCMI, and they paid it directly to the church. They could do that to all of you in the state of Utah if we still had what we had originally. And if you didn't like that, well, then you could go to Idaho. Because in Idaho, they worship the potato. I know, because I grew up there. And if you found it detestable to worship a potato, you could go to Wyoming and worship a cowboy. But every state was intended to be an experiment in sovereignty and in freedom. And the aberrations that would appear, the strange concoctions that the states would create of themselves, is just fine. Because the citizens of Vermont could say, I am sick of this government. And they could pack up and they could move to Rhode Island, or they could move to Virginia, or they could go to Ohio. And sooner or later, some state, like Texas is doing now, could say, come here. We're not going to tax you out of existence. We're going to issue you a sidearm when you come into the state. And we're going to let you shoot out of your car every road sign you see. And we'll replace them because we got oil money. And we can buy new road signs. Come to Texas. It's that guy on The Simpsons. Yeehaw! With the two guns going off. And so people from Massachusetts can look down their nose at the folks in Texas. And they can say, you know, they're ne'er-do-wells. They're hicks. And the people in Texas can say, thank God we're in Texas and not in Massadamchusetts. We should be so diverse. We should be so dissimilar. We should be so non-uniform that growing out of the United States, there should be, at this moment, 50 different experiments underway using the freedom that people have to choose to design for themselves the way in which they would like to be governed. And those 50 different ways will ultimately, some fail, some succeed, some turn into nirvana. And the states are going to look around and say, hey, that's good. And they're going to inform their own experiment in democracy by what they see working. And they're going to inform their own experiment in democracy by seeing what's failing and saying, well, that didn't work. I mean, look at that mess. Instead, what you have is a national uniformity in which when we make a mistake in economic policy, when we make a mistake in the way in which we proceed in trying to regulate and tax and govern, when we make a mistake in taking those who are most productive and confiscating money from them in order to subsidize behavior that we would really like to see end, when we make a mistake, we make a mistake on a grandiose scale. We make a mistake that is so threatening that it is possible to defeat the sovereignty of 50 states and to defeat the sovereignty of the entire union itself. And that was never what the Constitution set out to accomplish. The Constitution set out to accomplish, as a byproduct of the system, your freedom, your rights. And the way in which they accomplished it has been tampered with. Therefore, I don't care if you've got scriptures as a Latter-day Saint that you can thump on and say, the Constitution was divinely inspired. So what? Because every time you tinker with it, every time you change it, if you're not informed by the same degree of inspiration as was evident in the original creation, uninspired men who do have a tendency to become tyrannical, uninspired men who do want to exercise control and compulsion and dominion, they can take any gift given by God to any of us, and they can pervert it into something in which savage uniformity oppresses the hearts and the souls of men and renders it incapable of securing for the benefit of you and your posterity the freedom which we find in Christ, the original revolutionary,